Nikki opened the laptop and placed it on her lap. She almost flinched, as if it was actually painful for her to be so close to something that belonged to Mr. Nichols. Look. He pointed at the donations page. Look at this. People have sent money. For Norman. What do you mean? Just look, Jess. She squinted at the screen, moving the page up and down as she read, then reread it. But we can't take that. It's not for us. It's for Tansy and Norman. I don't understand. Why would people we don't know send us money? Because they're upset about what happened. Because they can see it wasn't fair. Because they want to help. I don't know. But how did they know? I wrote a blog about it. You did what? Something Mr. Nichols told me. About finding your people. I just put it out there. What was happening to us? Show me. Nikki switched pages then and showed her the blog. She read it slowly, her brow furrowed in concentration, and he felt a bit strange, like he was showing her part of himself that he didn't show anyone. Somehow it was harder to show all that emotional stuff to someone you knew. So, how much is the vet? He said, when he could see that she'd finished. She spoke like someone in a daze. £878.42. So far. Nikki lifted his hands in the air. So we're okay, yes? Look at the total. We're okay. She looked at him and he could see on her face the exact expression he must have worn half an hour previously. It's good news, Jess. Be pleased. And for a minute, her eyes brimmed with tears. And then she looked so confused that he leant forward and hugged her. This was his third voluntary hug in 3 years. Mascara, she said. She pulled back. Oh. He wiped under his eyes. She wiped hers. Good? Fine. Me? She leant forward and ran a thumb under the outer edge of his eye. Then she let out a breath, and suddenly she was a bit like the old Jess again. She stood up and brushed down her jeans. We'll have to pay them all back, of course. Most of them are like £3. Good luck with working that out. Tansy will sort it. Jess picked up the pink tissue parcel, and then, almost as an afterthought, she shoved it into a cupboard. She pushed her hair from her face. Then you have to show her the messages about maths. It's really important she sees those. Nikki looked upstairs towards Tansy's bedroom. I will, he said. And just for a minute, his mood dipped. But I'm not sure it's going to make any difference.
Chapter 37. Jess. Norman came home. And we have to help a hero, don't we, old chap, he said, patting Norman's side. The way the vet spoke to him, and the way that Norman immediately flopped to the ground for a tummy scratch, made Jess think this was not the first time he'd done it. As the vet dropped right down onto the floor, she caught a glimpse of the man beyond the careful professional manner. His broad smile, the way his eyes crinkled when he looked at the dog. And she heard Nikki's phrase running through her head as it had done for days. The kindness of strangers. I'm glad you made the decision you did, Mrs. Thomas, he said, pushing himself back onto his feet while they diplomatically ignored the pistol crack of his knees. Norman stayed on his back, his tongue lolling, ever hopeful, or perhaps just too fat to get up. He deserved his chance. If I'd known how his injuries had come about, I would have been a bit less reticent about proceeding. Tansy stayed pressed close to Norman's enormous black body as they lumbered home, clutching his lead like a lifeline. The walk from the vet's was the first time she had been outside in 3 weeks and hadn't insisted on holding Jess's hand. Jess had hoped that having him back would lift her daughter's spirits, but Tansy was still a little shadow, tailing her silently around the house, peering around corners, waiting anxiously beside her form teacher at the end of the day for Jess's arrival at the school gates. At home, she read in her room, or lay silently on the sofa watching cartoons, one hand resting on the dog beside her. Mr. Tsvangirai had been off since term restarted, some family emergency, and Jess felt a reflexive sadness when she pictured him discovering Tansy's determination to push mathematics from her life, the disappearance of the singular quirky little girl she'd been. Sometimes, she felt as if she had simply traded one unhappy silent child for another. St. Anne's rang to discuss Tansy's orientation day at the school, and Jess had to tell them that she wasn't coming. The words were a squat, dry frog in her throat.
"Well, we do recommend it, Mrs. Thomas. We find the children settle a lot better if they've familiarised themselves a little. It's good for her to meet a few fellow pupils as well. Is it a problem with getting time off from her current school?"
"No. I mean, she's not coming."
"At all?"
"No." A short silence.
"Oh," said the registrar. Jess heard her flicking through papers. "But this is the little girl with the 90% scholarship, yes? Costanza?"
She felt herself colour.
"Yes."
"Is she going to Petersfield Academy instead? Did they offer her a scholarship too?"
"No, that's not it," Jess replied. She closed her eyes as she spoke.
"Look, I don't suppose... Is there any way you could increase the scholarship any further?"
"Further?"
She sounded taken aback. "Mrs. Thomas, it was already the most generous scholarship we've ever offered. I'm sorry, but there's no question."
Jess pressed on, glad that nobody could see her shame.
"If I could get the money together by next year, would you consider deferring her place?"
"I'm not sure whether that would be possible, or even if it would be fair to the other candidates."
She hesitated, perhaps suddenly conscious of Jess's silence.
"But of course we'd certainly look at her favourably if she ever did want to reapply."
Jess stared at the spot on the carpet where Marty had brought a motorbike into the front room and it had leaked oil. A huge lump had risen into her throat.
"Well, thank you for letting me know."
"Look, Mrs. Thomas," the woman said, her voice suddenly conciliatory. "There's still another week to go before we have to close the place. We'll hold it for you until the last possible minute."
"Thank you. That's very kind of you, but really there's no point."
Jess knew it, and the woman knew it. It wasn't going to happen for them. Some leaps were just too big to make. She asked Jess to pass on her best wishes to Tansy for her new school. As she put the phone down, Jess could hear her already scanning her lists for the next suitable candidate. She didn't tell Tansy. She suspected she already knew. Two nights previously, she discovered Tansy had removed all her maths books from her cupboard and stacked them with Jess's remaining books on the upstairs landing, inserting them carefully between thrillers and a historical romance so that she wouldn't notice. Jess removed them carefully and put them in a neat pile in her wardrobe where they couldn't be seen. She wasn't sure if this was saving Tansy's feelings or her own. Marty received the solicitor's letter and rang, protesting and blustering about why he couldn't pay. She told him it was out of her hands. She said she hoped they could be civil about it. She told him his children needed shoes. He didn't mention coming down at half-term. She got her job back at the pub. The girl from the city of Paris had apparently disappeared to the Texas Rib Shack 3 shifts after she'd started. Tips were better, and there was no Stuart Pringle making random grabs at your backside.
No loss. She didn't know not to talk during the guitar solo of Layla, Des mused. What kind of barmaid doesn't know to keep quiet during the guitar solo of Layla?
She cleaned 4 days a week with Natalie and avoided No. 2 beachfront. She preferred jobs like scrubbing ovens, where she was unlikely to accidentally look through the window and catch sight of it, with its jaunty blue and white for sale placard. If Natalie thought she was behaving a little oddly, she didn't say anything. She put an advert in the local newsagents, offering her services as a handywoman. No job too small. Her first job came in less than 24 hours later, putting up a bathroom cabinet for a pensioner in Aden Crescent. The old woman was so happy with the result that she gave Jess a £5 tip.
She said she didn't like having men in her house, and that in the 42 years she had been married to her husband, he had only ever seen her with her Goodwill vest on. She recommended Jess to a friend in the sheltered housing, who had a washer needed replacing and a carpet gripper. Two other jobs followed, also pensioners. Jess sent a second instalment of cash to number 2 beachfront. Natalie dropped it in. The for sale sign was still up. Nicky was the only one in the family who seemed genuinely cheerful. It was as if the blog had given him a new sense of purpose. He wrote it most evenings, posting about Norman's progress, chatting with new friends. He met up with one of them, IRL, he said, translating that for Jess, in real life. He was all right, he said. And no, not like that. He wanted to go to open days at 2 different colleges. He was speaking to his form tutor about how to apply for a hardship grant. He looked it up. He smiled, often several times a day, and without being bribed, dropped to his knees with pleasure when he saw Norman wagging his tail in the kitchen, waved unselfconsciously at Lola, the girl from number 47, who, Jess noticed, had dyed her hair the exact same shade as his, and played an air guitar solo in the front room. He walked into town frequently, his skinny legs seeming to gain a longer stride, his shoulders not exactly back, but not slumped, defeated, as they had been weeks earlier. Once he wore a yellow T-shirt. "Where's the laptop gone?" Jess said, when she went into his room one afternoon and found him working away on their old computer. "I took it back," he shrugged. "Natalie let me in." "Did you see him?" she said, before she could stop herself. Nicky's eyes slid away. "Sorry. His stuff's there, but it's all boxed up. I'm not sure he stays there any more." It shouldn't have been a surprise, but as Jess made her way downstairs, she found herself holding her stomach with both hands, as if she had been winded.
Chapter 38. Ed. His sister accompanied him to court several weeks later, on a day that woke still and hot, and the traffic crawled as if the heat had slowed the very movement in London's veins. Ed had told his mother not to come too. By that time, they were never sure, day by day, whether it was a good idea to leave Dad for any length of time. As they crawled across London, his sister leant forwards in her taxi seat, her fingers tapping impatiently on her knee, her jaw set in a tight line. She was clearly even tenser than he was. Ed felt strangely, perversely relaxed. The weight of other, future losses hung over him, making today's troubles seem trivial. The courtroom was almost empty. Thanks to the unholy combination of a particularly grisly murder at the Old Bailey, a political love scandal, and the public meltdown of a young British actress, the 2-day trial had not registered as a big news story, just enough for an agency court reporter and a trainee from the Financial Times. And Ed had already pleaded guilty, against the advice of his legal team. Deanna Lewis's claims of innocence had been somewhat undermined by the evidence of a friend, a banker, who had apparently informed her in no uncertain terms that what she was about to do was indeed insider trading. The friend was able to produce an email she had sent informing Deanna as much, and one in return from Deanna accusing the friend of being picky, annoying, and, frankly, a little too involved in my business. Don't you want me to have a chance to move forward? Ed stood and watched the court reporter scribbling away, and the solicitors leaning into each other, pointing to bits of paper. And it all felt oddly anticlimactic.
"I am minded that you confessed your guilt, and that, as far as Miss Lewis and yourself are concerned, this appears to be isolated criminal behaviour, motivated by factors other than money. This cannot be said of Michael Lewis." The FSA, it turned out, had tracked other suspicious trades Deanna's brother had made, spread bets and options. "It is necessary, however, that we send a signal that this kind of behaviour is completely unacceptable, however it may have come about. It destroys investors' confidence in the honest movement in markets, and it weakens the whole structure of our financial system. For that reason, I am bound to ensure that the level of punishment is still a clear deterrent to anyone who may believe this to be a victimless crime. Ed stood in the dock, trying to work out what to do with his face, and was fined £750,000 and costs, and given a 6-month sentence, suspended for 12 months. And it was over. Gemma let out a long, shuddering breath, and dropped her head into her hands. Ed felt curiously numb. "That's it?" he said quietly, and she looked up at him in disbelief. A clerk opened the door of the dock and ushered him out. Paul Wilkes clapped him on the back as they emerged into the corridor. "Thank you," Ed said. It seemed like the right thing to say. He caught sight of Deanna Lewis in the corridor, in animated conversation with a red-headed man. He looked like he was trying to explain something to her, and she kept shaking her head, cutting him off. He stood staring for a moment, and then, almost without thinking, he walked through the throng of people and straight up to her. "I wanted to say I'm sorry," he said. "If I had thought for 1 minute..." She spun round, her eyes widening. "Oh, fuck off!" she said, her face puce with fury, and pushed past him. "You fucking loser!" The faces that had swiveled at the sound of her voice registered Ed, then turned away in embarrassment. Somebody sniggered. As Ed stood there, his hand still half lifted as if to make a point, he heard a voice in his ear. "She's not stupid, you know. She would always have known she shouldn't have told her brother." Ed turned, and there, behind him, stood Ronan. He took in his checked shirt and his thick black glasses, the computer bag slung over his shoulder, and something in him deflated with relief. You were here all morning." "Bit bored at the office, TBH. I thought I'd come and see what a real-life court case was like." Ed couldn't stop looking at him. "Overrated." "Yeah, that's what I thought." His sister had been shaking hands with Paul Wilkes. She appeared at his side, straightening her jacket. "Right, shall we go and ring Mum, give her the good news? She said she'd leave her mobile on. If we're lucky, she'll have remembered to charge it. Hi, Ronan." He leant forward and kissed her cheek. "Nice to see you, Gemma. Been a long time." "Too long. Let's go to mine," she said, turning to Ed. "It's ages since you saw the kids. I've got a spag bol in the freezer we can have tonight. Hey, Ronan, you can come too if you like. I'm sure we could bung some extra pasta in the pot." Ronan's gaze slid away, as it had done when he and Ed were 18. He kicked at something on the floor. Ed turned to his sister. Gem, would you mind if I left it? Just for today?" He tried not to register the way her smile fell. "I'll definitely come another time. There's a few things I'd really like to talk to Ronan about. It's been..." Her gaze flickered between them. "Sure," she said brightly, pushing her fringe from her eyes. "Well, call me." She hoisted her bag onto her shoulder and began to make her way towards the stairs. And he yelled across the busy corridor so that several people looked up from their papers. "Hey, Gem!" She turned, her bag under her arm. "Thanks. For everything." She stood there, half facing him. "Really. I appreciate it." She nodded, a ghost of a smile. And then she was gone, lost in the crowds on the stairwell. So, fancy a drink?" Ed tried not to sound pleading. He wasn't sure he was entirely successful. "I'm buying." Ronan let it hang there, just for a second. The bastard. "Well, in that case..." It was Ed's mother who had once told him that real friends were the kind where you pick up where you'd left off, whether it be a week since you'd seen each other or 2 years. He'd never had enough friends to test it.
He and Ronan nursed pints of beer across a wobbling wooden table in the busy pub, a little awkwardly at first, and then increasingly freely, the familiar jokes popping up between them like whack-a-moles, targets to be hit with discreet pleasure. Ed had an almost physical sense of relief at having him nearby, as if he had been untethered for months and someone had finally tugged him into land. He found himself gazing at his friend surreptitiously, noticing the things he remembered. His laugh, his enormous feet, the way he slumped over, even at a pub table, as if peering into a screen. And those things he hadn't seen about him before. How he laughed more easily, his new designer-framed glasses, a kind of quiet confidence. When he opened his wallet to pull out some cash, Ed caught a glimpse of a photograph of a girl beaming into his credit cards. So, how's Soup Girl? Karen? She's good. He smiled, the kind of smile that denotes private happiness, the kind where you have nothing to prove. She's good. Actually, we're moving in together. Wow, already? He looked up almost defiantly. It's been 6 months. And with rental prices as they are in London, those not-for-profit soup charities don't exactly make a fortune. That's great, Ed stuttered. Fantastic news. Yeah, well, it's good. She's great. I'm really happy. They sat there, silent for a moment. He'd had his hair cut, Ed noticed. And that was a new jacket. I'm really pleased for you, Ronan. I always thought you two would be great together. Thanks. He smiled at him, and Ronan grinned back, pulling a face like all this happiness stuff was a bit embarrassing. Ed stared at his pint, trying not to feel left behind, trying not to think about the fact that his own life was basically a mess, while his oldest friend was sailing on to a happier, brighter future. Around them, the pub was filling up with end-of-the-day office workers, secretaries in too high shoes, and young men trying to prove they were actually men. He suddenly had a sense of limited time, of the importance of laying things out, straight in front of him. I'm sorry, he said. What? About everything. About Deanna Lewis. I don't know why I did it. His voice emerged as a croak. I hate how I've messed things up. I mean, I'm sad about the job, yes. But mostly I'm just gutted that I messed us up. He couldn't look at him, yet it was a relief to say it. Ronan took a swig of his drink. Don't worry. I've thought about it a lot these past months, and while I kind of don't want to admit it, there's a good chance that if Deanna Lewis had come on to me, I would have done the same. A rueful smile. It was Deanna Lewis. She's really not what we thought she was. Believe it or not, I get that. Ronan grinned. Seriously, though, I'm sorry about all of it. Messing it all up. Our company, our friendship. If you knew what I've been like this last... Ronan shrugged as if Ed should say no more. They sat in silence. Ronan leant back in his chair. He bent a beer mat into two, and then into four. You know, it's been kind of interesting with you not being there anymore, he said finally. It made me understand something. I don't much like working at Mayfly. I liked it better when it was just you and me. All the suits, the profit and loss stuff, shareholders. It's not me. It's not what I liked about it. It's not why we started it. Me too. I miss you, but I don't miss them. I mean, the endless meetings. Having to run ideas past marketing people, even to proceed with basic code. Having to justify every hour's activity. You know they want to bring in timesheets for everyone? Actual timesheets? Ed waited. You're not missing much, I tell you. Ronan shook his head, as if he had something more to say, but felt he shouldn't. It felt momentous. It felt like that moment in a date where you're about to confess your feelings to the other person, not quite sure how they're going to respond. Ronan?
Yeah?
I had this idea, this last week or two, about a new piece of software. I've been fiddling around, working on a piece of predictive software, really simple stuff, that will help people plan their finances. A sort of spreadsheet for people who don't like spreadsheets, for people who don't know how to handle money. It would have alerts that pop up whenever the user was about to incur a charge from their bank. It would have an option calculation to show how much different interest charges would add up to over a set period of time. Nothing too complicated. I was thinking, it's the kind of thing they could give away at Citizens Advice Bureau.
Interesting.
It would need to be able to fit cheap computers, software that might be a few years old, and cheaper mobile phones. I'm not sure it would make much money, but it's just something I've been thinking about. I've outlined it, but... Ronan was thinking. Ed could see his mind working away, already chewing over the parameters. The thing is, it would need someone who is really good at coding to build it. Ronan watched his pint, his face neutral.
You know you can't come back to Mayfly, right?
He said. Ed nodded. His best friend since college. Yeah, I know. Ronan met his eyes, and suddenly they were grinning. Chapter 39. Ed. All these years, and he didn't know his own sister's number off by heart. All those years of her living in the same house, and he still had to look up her address. Those two things alone made Ed feel bad. He seemed to have an ever-growing list of things to feel bad about. He had stood outside the King's Head as Ronan headed off to the tube station, and a nice girl who made soup, whose presence in his life had given him a whole extra dimension, and he knew he could not go home to an empty flat, surrounded by boxes, the chill breath of its next owner in his lungs. It took 6 rings for her to pick up the phone, and then he heard someone screaming in the background before she actually answered.
"Jem?"
"Yes," she said breathlessly. "Leo, don't you throw that down the stairs!"
"Does that offer of spaghetti bolognese still stand?"
They were embarrassingly pleased to see him. The door of the little house in Finsbury Park opened, and he walked in through the bikes and the piles of shoes and the overloaded coat rack that seemed to extend the entire way along the hall. Upstairs, the relentless beat of pop thumped through the connecting walls. It competed with the cinematic sounds of a war game on some kind of games console.
"Hey, you!"
His sister pulled into her and hugged him tight. She was out of her suit, wearing jeans and a jumper.
"I can't even remember the last time you came here. When was the last time he was here, Phil?"
"With Lara," came the voice from down the corridor.
2 years ago."
"Where's the corkscrew, love?"
All was noise and chaos. The kitchen was filled with steam and the smell of garlic. At its far end, 2 clothes horses sagged under several loads of washing. Every surface, mostly stripped pine, was covered with books, piles of paper or children's drawings. Phil stood and shook his hand, then excused himself. "Got a few emails to answer before supper. You don't mind?"
"You must be appalled," his sister said, plonking a glass in front of him. "You'll have to excuse the mess. I've been on late shifts, Phil has been flat out, and we haven't had a cleaner since Rosario left. All the others are a bit pricey."
He had missed this chaos. He missed the feeling of being embedded in a noisy, thumping heart. "I love it," he said, and her eyes scanned his swiftly for sarcasm. "No, seriously. I love it. It feels...
messy,"
That too. It's good. He sat back in his chair at the kitchen table and let out a long breath.
Hey, Uncle Ed.
Ed blinked.
Who are you?
A teenage girl with burnished gold hair and several thick layers of mascara on each eye grinned at him.
Funny.
He looked at his sister for help. She raised her hands.
It's been a while, Ed. They grow. Leo, come and say hello to Uncle Ed. I thought Uncle Ed was going to prison,
came the cry from the other room.
Excuse me for a minute.
His sister left the pan of sauce and disappeared into the hall. Ed tried not to hear the distant yelp.
Mum says you lost all your money,
said Justine, sitting down opposite and peeling the crust from a piece of French bread. Ed's brain was desperately trying to marry the awkward, reed-thin child he had last seen with this tawny miracle who stared at him with faint amusement as if he were a museum curio.
Pretty much. Did you lose your swanky flat?
Any minute now.
Damn. I was going to ask you if I could have my 16th birthday party there.
Well, you saved me the trouble of a refusal.
That's exactly what Dad said. So, are you happy that you didn't get banged up?
Oh, I think I'm still going to be the family cautionary tale for a while. She smiled.
Don't be like naughty Uncle Edward.
Is that how it's being pitched?
Oh, you know, Mum. No moral lesson left unlearnt in this house. You see how easy it is to end up on the wrong path. He had absolutely everything, and now...
I'm begging for meals and driving a 7-year-old car.
Nice try, but ours still beats yours by 3 years.
She glanced towards the hall, where her mother was speaking to her brother in low tones.
Actually, you mustn't be mean about Mum. You know she spent all of yesterday on the phone working on how to get you into an open prison.
Really?
She was properly stressed about it. I heard her telling someone you wouldn't last 5 minutes in Pentonville.
He felt a pang of something he couldn't quite identify, at his utter ignorance of his sister's efforts on his behalf. So deep in self-pity had he been that he hadn't considered how others would be affected if he was sent to prison. She's probably right. Justine pulled a lock of hair into her mouth. She seemed to be enjoying herself.
So what are you going to do now you're a family disgrace with no job and possibly no home?
No idea.
Should I take up a drugs habit? Just to round it off.
Ugh, no. Stoners are so boring. She peeled her long legs off the chair.
And Mum's busy enough as it is. Although, actually, I should say yes. Because you've totally taken the heat off me and Leo. We now have so little to live up to.
Glad to be of help.
Seriously, nice to see you, though.
She leant forward and whispered,
You've actually made Mum's day. She won't say so, but she was really, really pleased you came. Like, embarrassingly so. She even cleaned the downstairs loo in case you turned up.
Yeah, well, I'm going to make sure I do it more often. She narrowed her eyes, as if she were trying to work out whether he was being serious, then turned and disappeared back up the stairs.
So what's going on?
Gemma helped herself to green salad.
What happened to the girl at the hospital? Joss? Jess? I thought she'd be there today.
It was the first home-cooked meal he'd eaten in ages, and it was delicious. The others had finished and left, but Ed was on his third helping, having suddenly reacquired the appetite that had disappeared for the last few weeks. His last mouthful had subsequently been a little overambitious, and he sat there chewing for some time before he could answer.
I don't want to talk about it. You never want to talk about anything. Come on. Price of a home-cooked meal.
We split up.
What? Why?
3 glasses of wine had made her garrulous, opinionated.
You seemed really happy. Happier than you were with Lara, anyway.
I was.
So? God, you're an idiot sometimes, Ed. There is a woman who actually seems normal, who seemed to have a handle on you, and you run a mile.
I really don't want to talk about it, Jem.
What was it? Too frightened to commit?
Too soon since the divorce? You're not still hankering after Lara, are you?
He took a bit of bread and wiped it around some sauce on the plate. He chewed for a minute longer than he needed to. She stole from me.
She what?
It felt like a trump card, laying it down like that. Upstairs, the children were arguing. Ed found himself thinking of Nicky and Tansy, placing bets in the back seat. If he didn't tell somebody the truth, he might actually explode. So he told her. Ed's sister pushed her plate across the table. She leant forwards, her chin resting in her hand, a faint frown bisecting her brow as she listened. He told the tale of the CCTV, how he had pulled out the drawers of the chest to move it across the room, and how there it had been, sitting on some neatly folded blue socks, his own laminated face.
I was going to tell you. It's not how it looks. The hand to the mouth. I mean, it is how it looks, but... Oh, God. Oh, God.
I thought she was different. I thought she was the greatest thing. This brave, principled, amazing... But fuck it. She was just like Lara. Just like Deanna. Only interested in what she could get out of me. How could she do that, Jen? Why can't I spot these women a mile off? He finished, leant back in his chair and waited. She didn't speak.
What? You're not going to say anything? About my poor judge of character? About the fact that yet again I've let a woman screw me out of what's mine? About how I'm an idiot on yet another count?
I certainly wasn't going to say that. What were you going to say?
I don't know.
She sat staring at her plate. She registered no surprise whatsoever. He wondered if 10 years of social work did that, whether it was now ingrained in her to appear visibly neutral, whatever shocking thing she heard.
That I see worse?
He stared at her.
Than stealing from me? Oh, Ed, you have no idea what it is to be truly desperate.
It doesn't make it okay to steal someone else's stuff.
No, it doesn't. But, one of us has just spent the day in court pleading guilty to insider trading. I'm not entirely sure that you're the greatest moral arbiter around here. Stuff happens. People make mistakes.
She pushed herself upright and began to clear the plates. Coffee? He was still staring at her.
I'll take that as a yes.
And while I'm clearing the plates, you can tell me a little more about her. She moved with a graceful economy around the little kitchen while he talked, never meeting his eye. She had her thinking face on. When he couldn't think of anything to do other than sit there with a slack jaw, Ed got up and helped her put the plates into the sink. She pushed a drying up cloth towards him.
So here's how I see it. She's desperate, right? Her kids are being bullied. Her son gets his head kicked in. She's afraid it'll happen to the little girl next. She finds a wad of notes at the pub or wherever. She takes them.
But she knew they were mine, Jem.
But she didn't know you.
And that makes a difference. His sister shrugged.
A nation of insurance fraudsters would say so.
Before he could protest again, she said,
Honestly? I can't tell you what she thought, but I can tell you that people in tight spots do things that are stupid and impulsive and ill thought out. I see it every day. They do idiotic things for what they think are the right reasons, and some people get away with it, and others don't.
When he didn't reply, she said,
Okay, so you never took a ballpoint home from work?
It was £500.
You never forgot to pay a parking meter and cheered when you got away with it?
That isn't the same.
You've never exceeded the speed limit? Never done a job for cash? Never bounced off someone else's Wi-Fi?
She leant forward.
Never exaggerated your expenses for the tax man? That isn't the same thing at all, Jem.
I'm just pointing out that quite often, how you see a crime depends on where you're standing. And you, my little brother, were a fine example of that today.
I'm not saying she wasn't wrong to do it. I'm just saying maybe that one moment shouldn't be the whole thing that defines her, or your relationship with her.
She finished the washing up, peeled off the rubber gloves, and laid them neatly across the draining board. Then she poured them both a mug of coffee and stood there leaning against the sink unit.
I don't know. Maybe I just believe in second chances.
Maybe, if you had the litany of human misery trudging through your working day that I do, you would too. She straightened up and looked at him.
Maybe if it were me, I'd at least want to hear what she had to say.
He couldn't think of a reply. Do you miss her? Did he miss her? Ed missed her like he would miss a limb. He spent every day trying to evade thoughts of her, running from the direction of his own mind, trying to dodge the fact that everything he came across, food, cars, bed, reminded him of her. He had a dozen arguments with her before breakfast, and a thousand passionate reconciliations before he went to sleep. Upstairs in a bedroom, a thumping beat broke the silence. I don't know if I can trust her, he said. Gemma gave him the same look she'd always given him when he told her he couldn't do something.
I think you do, Ed. Somewhere. I think you probably do.
He finished the rest of the wine alone, then drank the bottle he had brought with him, crushing out on his sister's sofa. He woke sweaty and dishevelled at 5:15 in the morning, left his sister a thank-you note, let himself out silently, and drove down to Beachfront to settle up with the managing agents. The Audi had gone to a dealer the previous week, along with the BMW he had kept in London, and he was now driving a 7-year-old Mini with a dented rear bumper. He had thought he'd mind more than he did. It was a balmy morning. The roads were clear, and even at 10:30 when he arrived, the holiday park was alive with visitors. The main stretch of bars and restaurants filled with people making the most of rare sunlight. Others were walking, laden with bags of towels and umbrellas, to the beach. Well-dressed children skipped past the open-air restaurant with the outdoor pizza oven, or dragged reluctant parents towards the covered pool. Tubs of seasonal flowers punctuated the pavement with perfectly laid out gaudy displays. He drove through them slowly, feeling irrationally furious at the sight of them, at this sterile semblance of a community, one in which everyone was in the same income bracket and nothing as messy as real life ever intruded as far as the perfectly aligned flower displays. He drove slowly past them all into the residential sector and pulled into the immaculate drive at 2, pausing to listen to the sound of the waves as he stepped out of the car. He let himself in and realized he didn't care that this would be the last time he came here. There was just a week left until he completed on the sale of his London flat. The vague plan was that he would spend the remaining time with his father. He had nothing planned beyond that. The hallway was lined with boxes bearing the name of the storage company that had packed them in his absence. He closed the door behind him, hearing the sound of his footsteps echo through the empty space. He walked upstairs slowly, making his way past the empty rooms. Here and there he saw evidence of the storage men's efforts, a stray roll of packing tape or an offcut of bubble wrap. But essentially, the whole house was packed and otherwise empty. Next Tuesday the van would come, load the boxes and take them away, until Ed could work out what to do with his stuff. Right up until then, he supposed, he had ploughed resolutely through what had been the worst few weeks of his life. If you had looked at him from the outside, you might have seen someone grimly determined, sucking up their punishment. He had put his head down and kept moving on. Perhaps drinking a little too much, but hey, considering he'd lost a job, a home, a wife, and was about to lose a parent, all in a little over 12 months, he thought he could have argued that he was doing okay. And then he spotted the 4 buff envelopes propped up on the kitchen work surface, his name scribbled on them in ballpoint pen. At first, he assumed they were administrative letters left by the managing agents. But then he opened one and was confronted by the filigree purple print of a £20 note. He extracted it, then pulled out the accompanying note, which said simply, "Third installment." He opened the others, tearing the envelope carefully when he reached the first. As he read her note, an image of her sprang unbidden to mind, and he was shocked by her sudden proximity, by the way she had been waiting there all along. Her expression, tense and awkward while writing, perhaps crossing out the words and reworking them. Here she would pull her ponytail from its band and retie it. "I'm sorry." Her voice in his head. "I'm sorry." And it was then that something started to crack. Ed held the money in his hand, and he didn't know what to do with it. He didn't want her apology. He didn't want any of it. He walked out of the kitchen and back down the hall, the crumpled notes clutched in his hand. He wanted to throw it all away. He wanted never to let it go. He felt as if something in him was about to combust. He walked from one end of the house to the other, backwards and forwards, trying to work out what he needed to do. He gazed around him at the walls he'd never had a chance to scuff, and the sea view that no guests had ever enjoyed. He had never felt at home there. He wasn't sure he'd ever felt at home. The thought of it, that he would never feel at ease anywhere, belong anywhere, was suddenly overwhelming. He paced the length of the hallway again, exhausted and restless, still overcome by the feeling that he should be doing something. He opened a window, hoping to be calmed by the sound of the sea, but the shouts of the happy families outside felt like a rebuke. A free newspaper sat folded on one of the boxes, obscuring something beneath. Exhausted by the relentless circling of his thoughts, he stopped and absent-mindedly lifted it. Underneath sat a laptop and a mobile phone. It was such an unlikely sight that he had to think for a minute to work out why they might be there. Ed hesitated, then picked up the phone, turning it over. It was the handset he had given Nicky back in Aberdeen, carefully hidden from the casual view of passers-by. For weeks, he had been fueled by the anger of betrayal. When that initial heat dissipated, a whole part of him had simply iced over, become glacial. He had been secure in his outrage, safe in his sense of injustice. Now Ed held a mobile phone that a teenage boy who possessed next to nothing had felt obliged to return to him. He heard his sister's words, and something began to open up almost audibly inside him. What the hell did he know about anything? Who was he to judge anyone? "Fuck it," he told himself. "I can't go and see her. I just can't. Why should I? What would I even say?" He walked from one end of his empty house to the other, his footsteps echoing on the wooden floors, his fist tight around the notes. What kind of a fool would forgive? He stared out of the window at the sea and wished suddenly that he had gone to jail. He wished that his mind had been filled with the immediate physical problems of safety, logistics, survival. He didn't want to think about her. He didn't want to see her face every time he closed his eyes. He would go. He would leave here and get a new place and a new job, and he would start again, and he would leave all this behind. And things would be easier. A shrill noise, a ringtone he didn't recognize, shattered the silence. His phone, recalibrated with Nicky's preferences. He stared at it, at the rhythmically glowing screen. Caller unknown. After 5 rings, when the sound became unbearable, he finally snatched it up. "Is Mrs. Thomas there?" Ed held the phone briefly away from himself, as if it were radioactive. "Is this a joke? he said, putting it back to his ear. A nasal voice sneezing.
Sorry, awful hay fever. Have I got the right number? Parents of Costanza Thomas? What? Who is this? My name's Andrew Prentice. I'm calling from the Olympiad.
It took him a moment to collect his thoughts. He sat down on the stairs.
The Olympiad? I'm sorry, how did you get this number? It was on our contacts list. You left it during the exam. I have got the right number.
Ed remembered Jess's phone being out of credit. She must have given the number of the phone he'd given to Nicky instead. His head dropped into his free hand. Someone up there had quite a sense of humour.
Yes. Oh, thank goodness. We've been trying you for days. Did you not pick up any of my messages? I'm calling about the exam. The thing is, we discovered an anomaly when we were marking the papers. The first one contained a misprint, which made the algorithm question impossible to solve.
What? He spoke as if reciting a well-worn series of statements.
We noticed it after the final results were collated. The fact that every single student failed the first question was a giveaway. It wasn't picked up on initially, as we had several different people marking. Anyway, we're very sorry, and we'd like to offer your daughter the chance to resit. We're doing the whole thing again.
Resit the Olympiad? When?
Well, that's the thing. It's this afternoon. It had to be a weekend, as we couldn't expect students to miss school to do it. We've actually been trying to reach you all week on this number, but we got no response. I only tried you the one last time on the off chance.
You're expecting her to get to Scotland in 4 hours? Mr. Prentice paused to sneeze again.
No, not Scotland this time. We had to take the space available to us. But looking at your details, I see this might work out better for you, seeing as you live on the south coast. The event is scheduled to take place in Basingstoke. Are you happy to pass the message on to Costanza? Thanks so much. I suppose these things are only to be expected in our first year. Still, one more down. I only have one more entrant to reach. The rest of the info is on the website if you need it.
An almighty sneeze. And the phone went dead. And Ed was left in his empty house, staring at the handset.
Chapter 40. Jess. Jess had been trying to persuade Tansy to open the door. The school counsellor had told her it would be a good way to start rebuilding her confidence in the outside world, as long as she was in the house. She would answer the door, safe in the knowledge that Jess was behind her. That confidence would slowly stretch to other people, to being in the garden. It would be a stepping stone. These things were incremental. It was a nice theory, if Tansy would only agree to do it. "Door, Mum!" Her voice carried over the sound of the cartoons. Jess was wondering when to get tough with her on the television watching. She had calculated last week that Tansy now spent upwards of 5 hours a day lying on the sofa. "She has had a shock," Mrs. Liversidge had said, "but I think she'd feel better sooner if she was doing something a little more constructive." "I can't answer it, Tans," she called down. "I'm standing here with my hands in a bowl full of bleach." Her voice, a whine, a new development these last days. "Can't you get Nicky to open it? Nicky's gone to the shop." Silence. The sound of canned laughter echoed up the stairs. Jess could feel, if not see, the presence of whoever was waiting at the door, the shadow behind the glass. She wondered if it was Aileen Trent. She had arrived uninvited 4 times over the last 2 weeks with unmissable bargains for the children. She wondered if she'd heard about Nicky's blog money. Everyone on the estate seemed to know about it. Jess yelled down, "Look, I'll stand at the top of the stairs. All you have to do is open it." The doorbell rang again, twice. "Oh, come on, Tans, it's not going to be anything bad. Look, put Norman on the lead and bring him with you.
Silence. Out of sight, she let her head drop down and wiped her eyes in the crook of her arm. She couldn't ignore it. Tansy was getting worse, not better. In the last fortnight, she had taken to sleeping in Jess's bed. She no longer woke, crying, but crept across the hallway in the small hours and simply climbed in, so that Jess woke beside her with no idea of how long she had been there. She hadn't had the heart to tell her not to, but the counsellor said pointedly that she was a little old to do that indefinitely.
Tans!
Nothing. The doorbell rang a third time, impatient now. Jess waited, her ears trained on the silence. She was going to have to go down and do it herself.
Hold on, she called wearily.
She began to peel off her rubber gloves, and then she stopped as she heard the footfall in the hallway. The lumbering, wheezing sound of Norman being tugged along, Tansy's sweet voice entreating him to come with her, a tone she only used with him these days. And then the front door opening. Her satisfaction at the sound was tempered by the sudden realization that she should have told Tansy to tell Aileen to go away. Given half a chance, she would be in with her black bag on wheels and straight past her, settling herself on the sofa and her bargains spread out on the living room floor. But it wasn't Aileen's voice she heard. Hey, Norman. Jess froze. Whoa, what happened to his face? He only has one eye now. Tansy's voice. Jess tiptoed to the top of the stairs. She could see his feet, his Converse trainers. Her heart began to thump. Did he have some kind of accident?
He saved me. From the fishers.
He what? And then Tansy's voice, her mouth opening and the words coming out in a rush.
The fishers tried to get me in a car, and Norman bust through the fence to save me, but he got hit by a car, and we had no money, but all these people sent money to us because of what Nicky wrote, and then the vet let us off half the bill because he said he'd never met such a brave dog.
Her daughter, talking as if she wouldn't stop. Jess took one step down, and then another.
He nearly died, Tansy said. He nearly died, and the vet didn't even want to give him an operation because he was so sick with infernal injuries, and he thought we should just let him go, but Mum said she didn't want to and that we should give him a chance, and then Nicky wrote this blog about how everything had gone wrong and some people just sent him money. Well, lots of people sent little bits of money for no reason, and we had enough to save him, so Norman saved me, and people we don't even know saved him, which is sort of cool, but he only has one eye now, and he gets really tired because he's still in recovery and he doesn't do very much.
She could see him now. He had crouched down and was stroking Norman's head, and she stared at him as if she couldn't tear her eyes away. The dark hair, the way his shoulders fitted his t-shirt, that grey t-shirt. Something rose up in her and a muffled half-sob came out so that she had to press her arm against her mouth. And then he looked up at her daughter from his low position, and his face was deadly serious. Are you okay, Tansy? She lifted a hand and twisted a lock of her hair, as if deciding how much to tell him.
Sort of.
Oh, sweetheart. Tansy hesitated, her toe rotating on the floor behind her, and then she simply stepped forward and walked into his open arms. He closed them around her, as if he had been waiting for just that thing, letting her rest her head against his shoulder. And they just stayed there, her wrapped in his arms in the hallway. Jess watched him close his eyes, and she had to take one step back up to where she couldn't be seen because she was afraid if he saw her, she wouldn't be able to stop crying. Well, you know, I knew, he said finally when he pulled back, and his voice was oddly determined. I knew there was something special about this dog. I could see it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You and him, a team. Anyone with any sense could see it. And you know what? He looks pretty cool with one eye. He looks kind of tough. Nobody's gonna mess with Norman. Jess didn't know what to do. She didn't want to go downstairs because she couldn't bear him to look at her the way he did before. She couldn't move.
She couldn't go down and she couldn't move. Mum told us why you don't come round any more. She did. It was because she took your money. A painfully long silence. She said she made a big mistake and she didn't want us to do the same thing.